It all started with a very simple idea. Tell the stories of how successful middle market CEOs made it to the corner office. I'm Brand Handley, founder and managing director of Resource Options International, or ROI. We're the USA's premier executive search firm focused exclusively on empowering middle market companies to attract, hire, and retain A players while transforming top executives' careers and lives. ROI's Into the Corner office is dedicated to discovering how middle market CEOs advance their career, and we're making these remarkable and sometimes quite unbelievable stories available to you for the very first time. Listen and learn about the challenges they've overcome, the interesting people they've met along the way, and the lessons learned that steered these executives' unique journey into a middle market corner office of their own. I know you enjoy these CEO stories as much as I've enjoyed recording them. So thank you for listening today. And if you like what you've heard, rate us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm looking forward to you joining me on the next great middle market CEO adventure into the corner office. Today, my guest is Nick McLean, partner and co-founder of Four Pillars Investors. Four Pillars is a private equity firm that partners with entrepreneurs and investors to purchase and operate lower middle market businesses with annual revenues between $20 million to $250 million and an untapped potential for growth. Four Pillars isn't your typical PE firm. They take a relationship-first approach and aren't about financial engineering or extreme cost-cutting. Instead, they leverage their experience as entrepreneurs to help grow companies in terms of revenues and employees. Nick has over 15 years of experience as a private equity investor and is highly regarded for his ability to find and invest in businesses that last far into the future. At Four Pillars, most of Nick's activities revolve around fundraising as well as deal origination and execution. He also runs a popular YouTube channel with over 250,000 views, where he regularly shares knowledge about the ins and outs of private equity investments and his growing audience. Nick McLean, welcome into the corner office.
Thank you, Brant. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. I know we had a couple of false starts to get us to this day, but I'm so glad we've had the opportunity to talk and get a chance to talk about your background and all the great things that are going on at Four Pillars. But we always like to start with kind of the early days and, you know, kind of where you grew up and what your early family life was like. So tell us about your, you know, mom and dad, parents, brothers, sisters, you know, all that inspired you as you were growing up.
Absolutely. I'll start by saying I really think I had a blessed childhood. Not necessarily super wealthy or anything along those lines, but I had two parents who I know loved me then and continue to love me. I had a great sister that was supportive as well. And so I think, you know, if you have family members that you still consider you're close to, both parents and siblings, I consider that, consider yourself to be pretty lucky. And I certainly consider myself to be lucky in that regard.
That's an important part of the foundation, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. I was born in a city outside of Kansas City, Missouri called St. Joseph. It's about 70 to 80,000 people. I think as an adult, you would say that St. Joseph was a good place to raise a family. As a kid, you kind of think that it's kind of boring because there's not a lot of distractions or attractions or ways to get in trouble. So we found other ways to get in trouble, I guess I should say. You know, as a kid or as a young person, you know, really bounced around in terms of what I thought I wanted to do. I think the earliest memory I have of what I wanted to be when I grew up was actually a neurosurgeon.
Wow.
It is kind of unique. And the reason why is I remember why. I read an article in Reader's Digest. If you remember that publication, it was about a neurosurgeon and it was really interesting. And even though I was only in kindergarten, I told my mom, I want to be a neurosurgeon, even though I probably didn't even know what it was.
That's so cool. What did mom and dad do? What were their professions?
So my mom worked in and around healthcare, largely around training and education. So she administered training. She administered training programs. She actually has her PhD in adult education as well. So very educated, you know, very education focused career and background. My father is more, you know, general business now, largely in finance roles, but at a time he was a certified public accountant, no longer, you know, hasn't kept up with the accreditation to be a practicing accountant or whatnot, but still does a lot in finance and accounting. And I will tell you that that has been a great help in my career, not necessarily in terms of setting me up for a huge success or whatnot, but as you probably know, in M&A, there are a lot of different accounting and finance type issues. And in this day and age, sure, you can go to Google and find an answer, but is that the right answer? If you keep looking, are you going to find an answer that's the exact opposite? Who knows? That's why it was so helpful to have my father as a source that I could rely on whenever I, you know, had accounting issues and whatnot.
Real good foundation there. Yeah. Well, if you had to kind of sum up, what kind of influence do you think your parents had on your growing up?
I just overall a great influence, really. I think, at the end of the day, I knew without any shadow of a doubt that my parents would be there for me when I needed them. Now, as a high schooler, as an adolescent, did they get on my nerves? You know, whenever I got in trouble, was I upset with them or whatever? Absolutely. But at the end of the day, I knew I could count on them. And also I would say that I didn't fully appreciate that at the time, because in my view, I think a lot of young people, at least for myself, kind of feel like other people's home environment isn't too dissimilar from your own.
Right.
And also, if you think about it, I mean, you should be able to count on your parents, like in a perfect world. But unfortunately, we don't live in a perfect world. And so I guess I was a bit sheltered in not fully appreciating how lucky I was to have such a great family to support me.
That's awesome. Other than neurosurgery, what other kind of inspirations did you have during your childhood?
Definitely loved science a lot. After, I know there were some interim career goals and whatnot, but after neurosurgeon, but after the next one that I actively remember was chemistry, something, you know, being a chemist, working in a lab, that type of thing. Love science. I remember my mom telling me how, you know, a lot of times she'd go in the bathroom and there'd be these little Dixie cups, if you remember those, with different potions that I had made. Usually they would spill out through the bottom of the cup because I'd leave them in there and without throwing them away, which my mom didn't love. However, she was tolerant of it. And I'm just glad that I didn't mix any chemicals together and create some noxious or dangerous fumes.
Right.
However, everybody, I think, is alive and well and wasn't damaged by those. So, you know, no harm, no foul, I guess.
It sounds like you're a pretty good student in school. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, I got mostly A's. I mean, I, as I'm sure many of the folks that you have on here, as well as, you know, many of your clients and whatnot, you know, somewhat competitive and also somewhat perfectionist. So, you know, if you ask me, did I get good grades? I would say, yeah, I got, you know, my grades were okay. However, okay means, you know, maybe a B here or there, that type of thing.
And what were some of your favorite subjects? You mentioned chemistry. Anything else that you took a liking to in those early years?
I mean, you know, definitely anything science related. Math was okay. I mean, math was never a huge challenge, but it also wasn't a huge area of interest, I wouldn't say. But again, like anything science related, that was really what I was excited about.
What about outside of class? You know, sports, music, theater, anything else there that had your interest growing up?
I would say my real strong interest through early childhood and into high school was basketball.
Right.
Unfortunately, I'm 5'10", which isn't, that doesn't make me a giant among men, I think you would appreciate. So basketball wasn't necessarily the sport that I was best set up in, but really enjoyed it, spent a lot of time playing it. And that was really what a lot of our friends we would all play basketball whenever we got together and whatnot, and really enjoyed it.
Yeah, that's awesome. And entrepreneurial activities, were you doing anything as a kid, you know, making money on the side, you know, doing the lawn mowing or paper delivery boy, anything like that?
No, not really. I never thought of myself as an entrepreneur until maybe early to mid 30s, I would say. I do think that I was responsible about money, and I would think about saving money. I would think about, is this the best use of the money that I have saved and that I had earned? But I, you know, I wish this were different, but I was never the guy that had the idea for a better mousetrap or a killer app. I wasn't the guy that always had, and I, you know, saw that there was a need for a lawnmower or a paperboy or whatever, and wanted to fill that need. So right. I still do consider myself an entrepreneur. It's just, it's a little bit slightly different flavor of entrepreneurism than, you know, the a lot of the stories we hear about where they, you know, started five businesses before they were 10 years old, you know, that type
sure,
of thing.
Sure. Was it pretty clear going to college? I mean, mom was a PhD, dad probably had a college degree. Was that something expected of you or just kind of always planned on?
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't really a discussion in our household. It was just kind of, you know, that's the next step, not necessarily any pressure there or expectation, just kind of, well, if you didn't go to college, what would you do? And you know, that type of thing. And even in high school, my expectation was to go back and get an MBA. You know, I had an uncle who was successful in business. He went to University of Missouri for undergrad, just like me, also got an MBA from Harvard. That was my role model. And that was kind of the path that I thought I wanted to go down.
Well, you went in and got an industrial engineering degree. Is that right? At the undergrad level?
It is. And I will tell you, I consider myself very, very lucky because it was actually my guidance counselor in high school that recommended that major to me. Wow. I never would have picked industrial engineering in a million years. I just didn't know anything about it. As we were talking, we realized that chemistry wasn't going to be a good fit. You know, brief digression here. I did work in a quality control lab testing chemicals for a couple of summers. And after about 1 month of working in the QC lab, I realized that chemistry probably wasn't going to be a good long-term career fit for me. So, you know, once I got some experience working in chemistry, I quickly pivoted. You know,
so
telling my
was that due to maybe explosions that happened in the lab, or was there something else that turned you off of chemistry? Because it sounds like you really had a love for science.
Fortunately for everyone, there were no explosions, at least none that I know about. You know, it's a very good question and one I haven't really thought about. I think at the end of the day, well, let me step back. I worked in a quality control lab. You know, quality control is less about being creative and inventive and more about making sure that whatever you're testing conforms to the standards. I do believe that if I had been in a more, you know, inventive or creative type chemistry role, then my views might have been different. But because I was in a quality control type role, that's what I associated all chemistry to be like. And that's, in my view, why it became less interesting to me.
Yeah, I understand. Well, what was that first job you took coming out of undergraduate? Because you worked for a few years before you went back for MBA, right?
Yep. So the plan was always to go into consulting. That's what, you know, folks smarter than me had suggested. So worked for Deloitte Consulting for 2.5 years, largely with manufacturing clients on process improvement, process standardization, et cetera, et cetera. Worked on some really interesting projects and clients. Actually got to take a trip to China. Also a couple of trips to Germany, actually, in addition to weekly travel to various destinations within the United States. Whenever I went into consulting, you know, I really had the idea that it was going to be a 2 to 5 year type or 2 to 5 year length of employment there. I stayed there for 2.5 years, a little bit on the shorter end. And the reason for that is because I saw myself going down an increasing path of specialization where I was really trying to keep my career experiences as broad as possible. So that was what led me to apply for business school when I did.
Got it. And in those first kind of consulting roles, were you individual contributor? Did you have any leadership responsibility during those days?
Largely individual contributor. There were some analysts that, you know, somewhat kind of, you know, iffy type, you were reported to me more informally, I guess I should say. But again, largely individual contributor.
Now, you went back to the University of Michigan for your MBA. Great school. That's in Ann Arbor, right?
Correct.
And what made you choose that location?
Well, I'll be honest with you. Harvard was definitely my far and away top choice. Didn't get in there. Not only did I not get accepted, didn't even get invited to a first-person interview or in-person interview. And what that means is essentially they look at your application, laugh, and then either burn your application because it was so bad, or at least put it in the trash can so that there's no fire hazard or whatnot. I joke. I hope you realize. You know, since I didn't get into Harvard, it really came down to Kellogg and Michigan. I visited both schools, just really had a great feeling about Michigan, decided to go there, and it was a great experience.
Awesome. And then what was the next step after that coming out? Back into consulting?
No. You know, I need to talk a little bit more about that, because going into grad school, my expectation was that I would work for a Fortune 500 company in a rotational program of some sort. I would stay with that company for 20 to 30 years. I would get the gold watch and then retire, or retire and then get the gold watch. I'm not sure which the proper chronology is, but you know, I just thought I was going to be a one company guy and spend my entire career there and try and rise through the ranks. In grad school, got exposed to private equity, got exposed to investment banking. Really what I got exposed to was M&A within the middle market and the lower middle market, and it just fascinated me. So while I was in school, pivoted from pursuing operations type positions to something in investment banking or private equity. After grad school, my first role was with a boutique M&A shop in St. Louis, stayed there for about a year and a half. And really that's a similar story repeated at many of my future roles. I would accept a position that at the outset sounded really exciting and like it would really advance my career. And somewhere between 6 and 12 to 18 months later, not only would I be less excited about the opportunity, I really wouldn't like the opportunity at all.
Hmm.
After one or two of those, you can chalk it up to bad luck or bad decision-making or whatever. After 4 or 5, at that point, I think you got to kind of have to look at yourself in the mirror. And that's exactly what I did. I realized I was more entrepreneurial than I gave myself credit for.
Hmm.
Now, there's a term that has been popularized within the last 3 to 5 years that I wasn't familiar with at the time, but that term is called entrepreneurship through acquisition. That's the flavor of entrepreneurship that really resonates with me, because like I said, I didn't have all these ideas for great businesses to start, even though I wish I would have. But buying a business, growing it, buying other businesses, that's what really got me excited. And that's why I now call myself an entrepreneur.
I love that. You'd mentioned earlier about your, being drawn to the middle market. And as I think you know, as we've discussed before, our search practice is focused on middle market companies. Love that. And I have my own reasons. But tell us a little bit about what attracted you to them and what's kept you there.
Really, I would say a big part of it has been the lack of bureaucracy and other red tape associated with large organizations. I'm sure you've worked with large organizations before, and I mean, it's incredibly difficult to get anything done. even things that are small that you shouldn't think would be an issue at all. Companies in the lower middle market, they don't have the luxury to spend 3, 4, 5 months making decisions. I mean, I'll give you an example. One of our portfolio companies was applying for a supplier code for a very large, well-known company. I mean, how long do you think that would take? Well, we thought, okay, no more than 6 months. Well, it wasn't 6 months. It was 18 months.
Oh,
18 months to get a supplier code from a large manufacturer, even though their engineers were screaming down our necks about how badly they needed our capabilities and capacity.
I couldn't agree with you more. The same reason as we're attracted. We started kind of our Goldilocks journey in search, starting with startups. A lot of fun, not a lot of money. more stock certificates than I know what to do with. Held our own with enterprise and large corporate customers. But there's something about that middle market. You know, they're about having fun and making money. They don't have that big bureaucracy. And it's really just pure business. It's getting stuff done. It's P&L. It's, you know, making things happen every day that continue to grow. And you have a lot more, what we found, a lot more cultural diversity right? You know, people that are really, you know, engaged and do well in the middle market tend to have very strong cultures. Have you found that as well, Nick?
Oh, absolutely. One thing that I've talked about on some of the videos that I've recorded for my YouTube channel is that you look at the value or mission statement for these large companies, and they all say things like ethics and integrity and honesty. And quite frankly, you can't tell them apart. Now, how can you tell me that your company has a unique culture when your mission statement and your values and all that sound very similar to every other company out there? Well, I don't think you can. So I completely agree with you that, you know, once you get that large, it just becomes more and more homogenous in terms of your company culture.
We talked a little bit about four pillars as well in the introduction. Tell us what kind of led you to, you know, found the company and, you know, kind of your last couple of experiences before getting involved or co-founding Four Pillars Investors almost 10 years ago.
Well, I told you that after 6, 12, 18 months, I was in these roles and I didn't like them. What I was looking for in those roles was I didn't necessarily have to be president or CEO, but I wanted a seat at the table where I wasn't necessarily making the decision, but I at least got to hear the decision makers talking about it, voice my input, even if it wasn't accepted, that type of thing. You know, what I realized that if I wanted a seat at the table, not only was I going to have to build the seat myself, I was going to have to build the table as well. So after I realized that, the next step or the strategy became clear is that I had to start my own business with the goal of being to purchase a business that I would then run.
Yeah. Yeah. So clear. And so 10 years ago, you sought out on this mission and you've got some co-founders. I think they're all CEOs, right? They've all run different types of companies. Tell us a little bit about kind of how you found those folks and, you know, how Four Pillars was formed.
Absolutely. So I was working on a deal for a small machine shop and had a hole of equity of, you know, a couple $100,000 or whatever the number was. I was reaching out to my network trying to fill that hole, and a deal attorney that I knew encouraged me to talk to this guy named Thomas Sanford. Of course, happy to talk to Thomas. Good meeting with Thomas. After the meeting, he told me, yes, Nick, I would like to invest in this deal. However, I don't just want to invest in this deal. I want to be partners with you. What do you think? Well, at first I thought, well, the answer should obviously be no, because anybody that is crazy enough to want to partner with me clearly has a bad decision-making process. You know, after I, you know, got over that initial reaction, I was really open to it. And, you know, we tried to have a accelerated, you know, get to know you process. You know, what we realized through that is we're both pretty even-keeled guys. We're both pretty reasonable, and we care about being fair to the other person, even sometimes at the expense of what's fair to us. And thought it was a good idea, and ultimately decided to, in fact, join forces and become equal partners. And I will tell you that it's really been one of the best decisions I've made. I mean, Thomas is, I would consider him one of my best friends, if not my best friend. I talk to him more than anybody except for my wife and kids. We have been through a lot of good times, a lot of bad times, and I think that our relationship at present is as strong or stronger than it ever has been, with literally, I would say, zero cracks. I just think that he's going to be a lifelong friend and business partner, and I'm very happy about that.
That's really rare.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, before we get off that topic, I just want to, because it's a interesting, that first deal that we looked at, We're really happy that we did not pursue that deal. 2 to 3 years after we were looking at it or reading in the paper, the seller got sentenced to federal prison because he defrauded his buyers. So Thomas and I really dodged a bullet on that first deal that we looked at together.
Gosh, that's great. And did you bring on other partners, or has it been the two of you? And tell us a little bit about, you know, your firm today.
Yep. Just the two of us as partners. We do have one other member of the team named Jacob Cohen, who's largely responsible for business development and bringing in new acquisition opportunities. pretty lean shop, but that's because, you know, we're not trying to close 10 deals a year. Really, we're trying to close one or two. And that's a pace of acquisitions that between the three of us, we can handle.
And you work in kind of that 20 million to 250 million space. Are you working across sectors? Are you agnostic when it comes to industry?
If you look at our portfolio today, it's overweight in manufacturing, but you know, part of the reason for that is my background in industrial engineering. Another reason for that, though, is that in the Kansas City area, you really can't go too far without running into a manufacturing company. However, that has changed. I would say that right now we look at companies in a very, very wide range of industries. I mean, there's a couple that we won't pursue, but generally speaking, we are not the type that looks at a deal, and if it doesn't perfectly check all 10 or 20 or 200 boxes, we cast it away. We are very much of the mindset that there might be a diamond in the rough here. Let's take the mindset that that is in fact the case until we're proven wrong.
And about how many portfolio companies do you have at the moment?
Well, let's see. It depends on how you categorize them, but I would say we have about four portfolio companies right now. We have two companies that are related, common ownership in Portland, as well as a third one that is a little bit smaller that is not common ownership. We have a steel fabrication company in Kansas City here. That is the company that I ran for a period of time.
Right.
And then we have an aluminum die casting operation with a facility in Chicago and a facility outside of Cleveland.
And I assume you kind of sit on their boards. Is that kind of how you exert influence over time and, you know, get involved in their management as well? Or what does that look like ongoing?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm on the board of all of the companies I mentioned there. Our ideal situation is whenever we find a company that has a really strong management team that we can help, you know, help their efforts, help them, you know, be more rigorous in capital expenditure decisions, help them think about strategy, help them gain from what we've seen from working with companies in other industries and whatnot. You know, we're really not trying to say that we're the smartest people in the room and we'll run your company better than you. The opposite, really. It's we want you guys to be the smartest. We'll ask some dumb questions that will hopefully cause you to get to thinking and maybe view something different. But you know, if you want to work with us, you got to brace yourself for us asking a lot of dumb questions, because that is definitely the first stage of the process whenever we get involved.
What do you look for when you evaluate these companies, Nick?
Well, it's a very qualitative answer, but we look for companies with an untapped potential for growth. It's a bit of a tagline, but it's really what we look for. So often we see companies with an owner that, you know, perhaps they're in their 60s or 70s that, you know, that used to have a whole bunch of energy or desire to grow the business. But over time, those desires and risk tolerances change. And, you know, maybe, and also as you get to be a owner of a company that's throwing off 3, 4, 5 million of EBITDA, you know, does it really impact your lifestyle or your happiness if you take that from, you know, 4 million of EBITDA to 8 million or 12 million? Possibly not. Just because risk tolerances change or just because motivations change doesn't mean that there's not the potential for growth for those companies. Those are the types of situations that really get us excited, where you talk to a business owner, they say, listen, guys, there is a lot of opportunity. It's X, Y, and Z. I don't want to put all my life's work, all my personal net worth on the line to pursue those growth opportunities. I'm willing to put some of it on the line, but I'm not willing to fund 100% of it. That's why we're in these talks. Those are the types of situations that get us pretty excited.
Yeah. What would you say is kind of the common through line or the common thread among the companies that you bring in as part of your portfolio? Other than growth, I mean, I get that, you know, there are obviously folks that, you know, want to invest and grow in the future, but, you know, are there cultural similarities or size of employee base or, you know, age and financial position of their owners or, you know, any other consistent, you know, threads there?
Oh, sure. I mean, I would say age of the owners is typically higher. but I think that's a little bit less interesting one. What I think perhaps is more a more interesting thread to talk about is the level of sophistication of the company. Typically what we see, or typically what we like in the acquisitions that we look at, are companies that have started down the path of increasing the sophistication, starting to implement those processes and procedures so that it's not entirely new, but also all of the work hasn't been done. As an example, sometimes we'll talk to companies and we'll say, well, how do you do processes X, Y, and Z? They'll say, oh, well, you know, Joe really handles X and Y, and then Sam handles Z. Well, what happens when Joe's out of town? Well, you know, he does a lot of work before he goes out of town. So he really, you know, tries to make his absence not felt very much. And then, you know, when he gets back, it's, oh yeah, he's super slammed and whatnot. You know, those are the situations that, you know, at first make us a little nervous, but we also see opportunity there, because the challenge or why that isn't desirable is because, sure, Joe can probably handle it at the level of revenue, at the level of earnings you are. What if you add another facility? What if you add another shift? What if you add a huge new customer that really challenges your systems and whatnot? Well, Joe's not going to be able to handle it, not because of any personal shortcoming, but a person's brain can only handle and process so much. So that's why, you know, with my background in industrial engineering, with the work that we've done in these other companies, is we really like companies that are on the verge of starting down the path of increasing sophistication, because if we want to get the dollars that we target upon an exit, it can't look like a mom and pop. It has to look like a company that is actually more mature, more sophisticated than its size, its revenues and earnings would might indicate.
Yeah, not relying on any one or two people in the organization as well. That's important.
Right. Yep. Yeah.
Yep. Are there some cultural similarities that you look for?
Well, I would say the cultural similarities are pretty simple. It's, is this the type of person that I'm going to dread every time I have to call? Or is this the type of person that I'd be open to having dinner with or having a beer with? Or, you know, if they're in the same city, having, you know, their family over to socialize with my family.
Right.
You know, I just think if you can... if there's a person that you feel like you could have a good, enjoyable relationship with, that goes a long way, and it really helps smooth over any differences you might have in terms of where you think the company should go, what the strategy should be, et cetera.
And are the positions that you take wholly owned, partially owned, majority owned, minority owned? What does that look like?
Typically, when we're involved in a transaction, it's going to be a change of control transaction. Typically, not 100%, somewhere in the 70 to 90%.
Yeah,
change of control is what we typically target.
And the funds are typically used to support growth.
Yes and no. I mean, I would actually say more of the funds are used for existing shareholder liquidity. If there's a $50 million transaction, I would say that generally speaking, most of that is going to go to the exiting shareholders. If there is a need for additional growth capital, that would be provided by the capital source at a later date whenever we identified specific areas where we wanted to make those expenditures.
I looked on your LinkedIn page and I know I loved your headline, actively seeking acquisitions. So is that still the case, Nick? Are you looking to continue to increase the portfolio at this stage?
Brant, I don't think there's going to be a day on this earth when I'm not actively seeking acquisitions.
Sounds like you're really enjoying it.
Absolutely. What I always tell people is if you work in business and you can't get excited about M&A, then you shouldn't be working in business. It to me is the most exciting part of business, hands down. So yeah, I get excited about it. I'm not going to say that I'm the most exciting guy at the party. I mean, I'm probably going to be the most boring guy probably, but you know, right or wrong, I like M&A, and I'll always, the rest of my career will be spent in M&A.
I love it. Great. Well, Nick, we're almost out of time. This has been very, very educational and love the work that you're doing. We always have kind of one last question we always ask our CEO guests, and that's, you know, what kind of career and life advice would you give to someone that has their own eyes on the corner office, or in particular, in your case, wants to be an entrepreneur themselves?
You know, I think a lot of people talk about success and achievement in terms of working hard. I think working hard is absolutely critical, but I don't think that it's all that you need. I also hear some people say, well, you got to work hard, but you also need a little bit of luck. I agree with that as well. However, what you don't hear people talking about as much, at least in my opinion, is that if you really want to have outsized success, you need to be willing to take risks. You need to be willing to bet on yourself that you can overcome the odds and make it on your own, or you can take that risk and you can succeed. Now, I'm not saying you can't be successful without taking a lot of big risks, but if you want to be a CEO that really accomplishes great things for your company, then you have to get comfortable with taking risk.
Got it. Right on. Nick McLean is one of the founders of Four Pillars Investors. Four Pillars is a private equity firm that purchases and operates businesses in the lower middle market. That's 20 million to about 250 million in sales. And their ideal acquisition candidate are companies with untapped potential for growth. Nick McLean, thank you so much for sharing your journey into the corner office.
Thank you, Brant.
Thank you for listening to Into the Corner Office with Brant Hanley. We hope you enjoyed hearing our guest CEO story as much as we did. If you want to hear more CEOs reveal their journey into the corner office, please subscribe via iTunes and tell your friends and colleagues. For more information about Brant, Resource Options International, and the Mighty Middle Market, visit www.goforroi.com. We look forward to having you join us for our next episode.